The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. We are here on Memorial Day, actually. We hope that you're enjoying time with family and that you're remembering our fallen, because it's not just the second Veterans Day. This is the one where we remember folks who have given their lives for our country.
Yeah, take some time and visit a memorial.
Exactly. There are lots of events going on, especially Monday. So we're here with Nina Salerno with Crime Victims United. And I really didn't realize, Nina, how far behind, actually, some of the victims' laws were around the country. I guess by the time I started paying attention to that stuff, it seemed like victims had a lot of rights.
Yeah, it's definitely been a growing process, to say the least.
And is it typically championed by people who have been impacted, like your family?
Yes. And everybody knows Mark Foss. I work a lot with Mark. It's been those motivating factors. And that's kind of the only sad thing that I think is it seems to always take a tragedy to spark differences. And I think you said it better earlier. You had an analyst on to say, you know, sometimes we forget when crime is not on the rise, it becomes a secondary issue. It's not in the forefront. And unfortunately, it's probably going to take another tragedy to bring back change to have safer communities.
Well, because that's where California's headed. I mean, obviously, with AB 109, the prison overcrowding thing, so we let a whole bunch of people out. And then Prop 47, we turned a bunch of felonies into misdemeanors and basically let a whole bunch of other people out. You know, we're seeing even in our small towns. Oh, and then the legalization of, drugs. I was up in Siskiyou County, last Thursday, I guess. It's a county with, I don't know, several thousand people. I mean, it just doesn't have that many people in the whole county. And they have Asian gangs carrying, like, machine guns in their neighborhood, threatening the people who live there on, like, five-acre parcels in a rural subdivision. And bottom line is, by the time the police get there, they're gone. And they're still patrolling the neighborhood after the police leave, so nobody can say anything. And these are the folks that are the big dope growers. And California's looking at legalizing marijuana. I mean, how crazy is that?
It is crazy. I mean, I think everything, with, like, I go back to even within our system, is a balance. There was a legalization for medical needs, and according to the medical community, there were medical needs for that. If it is going to be legalized in California, but then we have to look at putting in things such as, you know, how do you tell somebody's under the influence when they're driving, because it's not a test like a DUI. So there's going to need to be, if we're looking at it, and like you bring in the gangs, how are we going to deal with all of that? You know, we're so close to Mexico, how are we going to deal with the cartels? And I think before things, if they do move towards legalization, that also needs to be looked at. Then how are we going to protect our citizens?
Oh, yeah, because up there, this is not a major metropolitan area. And yet if you go into their shopping center, because they really only have one big shopping center in Yreka, they see all these license plates from Wisconsin and Minnesota and all these places out of town, and they've come there to grow pot.
Right. I mean, it's an industry, let's say that. And like I said, I think however the trend goes, I mean, obviously sometimes you can't stop trends. There's differing philosophies. But I think it has to look at then, if it's going to be implemented, what do we put in place to make sure that public safety is still upheld? So we don't have people driving under the influence and killing other people. So we don't have cartels coming in. What are we going to do? Those are those questions. And I go back to even like with some of the initiatives and propositions about rehabilitation or prison overcrowding. I don't think there was a lot of thought then, okay, if we're going to implement these, let's do it strategically. Let's do it right. Let's still keep public safety in the forefront.
Yeah, because, I mean, as a prosecutor, I'm sure you were gritting your teeth through that whole thing.
It was frustrating because I don't, and especially because I don't think victims were being heard. And again, because I don't think people understood that violent crimes is a very narrow category in California. That somehow just got missed in the whole play. And like I said, some of those things that received lesser sentences, I'm not saying all, but some didn't, should not have been. I mean, I think domestic violence, and perhaps it's because of my personal story with my sister, because of having been a domestic violence prosecutor, is probably one of the most misunderstood crimes and the most not effectively remedied crimes, meaning rehabilitated for the person. And to see it not be considered a violent crime in our system, I always found that kind of amazing. Because obviously those are the most vulnerable victims. There's a relationship there and an intimate relationship.
We don't consider... Wait, say that again? Domestic violence isn't considered...
Domestic violence is not considered a serious or violent crime in California.
Holy crap.
That was one of the things that was kind of missed when some of these initiatives came in. There was that, some child sexual assault was not considered... If a child's over 14, it's not considered violent or serious in California. Well, I have teenagers, and to me, they're actually almost more vulnerable than the younger ones because we tend to watch our younger ones more closely.
Yeah, they have a wider wider range.
Right. You know, and as you try to raise your kids, you try to teach them independence and freedom, but so our system says it's not violent or serious if they're over 14. And I just always thought that was just not correct because there's so much vulnerability there that can be preyed on.
Oh, my gosh, yes. I had no idea. Well, you would...
You know, and especially... Go ahead.
Well, you would think if it was a... I mean, I don't know. How do you say if it's a domestic violence thing that that's not violent?
It's not considered a serious or violent felony in California, and that was something that some of these initiatives actually have made for lighter sentences of. And again, like I said, those are, I think, some of our more prevalent crimes and some of our most dangerous crimes because of that relationship.
Well, it's kind of
weird.
And
then you add in, like we were just talking about with sexual assault and teenagers, you add in the whole cyber world on top of it now.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's kind of odd because police know that domestic violence things are super dangerous. And that's where all sorts of bad things happen.
Oh, yeah, when the woman goes, or the man, depending. I mean, there's male victims, too. Go to leave is usually the most dangerous time. And, again, it's something that's just was missed when all this was thought about. And I'm not saying anybody's intentions, like I said, and the philosophies were wrong. I just think it wasn't vetted well.
Yeah. And what about death penalty? Since you've looked at crime across the country and from a victim's standpoint, Does death penalty, places that have it and use it, they have fewer,
you know? I can share with you a pretty personal story on that where I see what the benefit, and I share this with the legislature. I am, in my role at the state of California with the Attorney General's office, I had the privilege of starting the first Office of Victim Services for the statewide office of California. And I authored what was called the Death Penalty Notification Program where prior to that, we did a horrible job of involving victims in the process, keeping them informed. So we started this process, and in my tenure there were four executions where we involved the victims' families. They were able to all speak at the clemency. And two things I would say to that. There are some victims that don't believe in the death penalty and didn't want it, but I only came across one victim in my entire time there that just had a strong moral belief against the death penalty. The other victims wanted to see it proceed. And so it's kind of a long story, and bear with me, but this will apply to your county. And I believe, what county are you guys out of?
We're in Shasta County.
Okay, it's a Shasta County case. In 1979, a man named Darrell Keith Rich rained terror on your county for 2 weeks. And by the time he was done, 11 women had been assaulted and or murdered, including a 12-year-old girl that he threw off a 101-foot bridge after he had sodomized her, broke every bone in her body, and she bled to death for 24 hours. And there were about four surviving women. My facts might be a little bit off because it's been a while, but one of the surviving assault victims and I were walking out of the execution chamber when it was all over that night, And I'll never forget this. She turned to me and said, thank you. And I said, no, I should be thanking you for the courage to have spoken out. And she said, no, thank you. She said, for the first time since this happened 16 years ago, I'm going to sleep in peace tonight. I'm not going to worry about getting a phone call that his sentence was overturned. I'm not going to worry about getting a phone call that he escaped. I'm not going to worry that he's outside these prison walls and going to come back and finish killing me because I testified against him. To me, that was the true value of the death penalty. That's when I learned it. For these victims, it was the ultimate peace. And to hear this young woman say that just really, and to this day, I almost tear up when I think about it. It just gave the true value as to why the death penalty is reserved for the worst of the worst and why, from a victim perspective, it is such a necessary sense of justice.
Wow. Well, oh, Bob's giving us the high sign so we don't get behind again. All right.
I'm sorry. I'm probably talking too much. Passion, and I apologize.
No, that's why you're here. That's our problem is we get all caught up in the story, and then it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. We can't just go endlessly. We'll just take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay. All right. Bye.
We're chatting with Nina and Salerno from Crime Victims United. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Welcome back. All right, so Nina, we have a chat window going here on Sunday afternoons during the program, and so we've got some questions. How long did the Daryl, what's his face? How long did he stay on death row before they actually executed him?
It was, and again, it's testing my memory.
Ballpark.
But I want to say it's either 16 or 17 years.
Okay, and so. What about all these, you know, I mean, it seems like people get the death sentence and then nothing happens. They don't actually die. They just hang out on death row. Is it?
Until they die.
Yeah, until they die. I mean, it's kind of like the same death sentence they would have gotten, you know.
It's room and board for the rest of their life.
From being alive. Does that change their parole thing and the ability, I guess, for them to come up for parole? And does it matter? I mean, if we have a death sentence and we don't use it, is it still worth having?
Well, the death sentence does not make them eligible for parole. They're obviously fought in the appeal process. And like I said, there are two competing initiatives this year. One is to make it still a fair process, but a more streamlined process so that it would actually probably not speed up, but would speed up the system, I guess is the best word. Not sponsored by the California District Attorney's Association. And again, I do believe it's worth still having, even though the wheels of justice are slow, because if you take off the ultimate punishment that is reserved for the worst of the worst, then I think the system's going to be harmed, because then the ultimate punishment is life without the possibility of parole. Well, what happens, and as a prosecutor, if you do charge death, there becomes some negotiations. As we all know in our system, a lot of cases go by way of plea bargain. So somebody may actually flee and spare a family from going to trial to life without possibility of parole to not receive the death sentence. So if you remove that death sentence, then the plea becomes life with the possibility of parole. And that then puts families and victims in having to endure parole hearings. So I do think it's important to have. Again, I am a supporter of the death penalty. I believe that our district attorneys do an excellent job of applying discretion when they charge it. Like I said, it's reserved for the worst usually multiple murderers or the murder of a peace officer, or there's a whole host of special circumstances. And I think what we also forget is that it is, our system is the greatest system. You know, I may not always agree with the jury verdicts I got, but I believe in our system because we have a jury system. So 12 individuals, the peers of that individual, decided that the case was heinous enough not only to convict the person of first-degree murder, which is a premeditated murder, but then to go through a penalty phase and decided that what acts this individual did rose to such an atrocious level of disregard for human life that they deserve a death sentence. And I think we usurp our jury system when we do not honor that. I mean, our whole system was based on that. We're the only country in the world that where you are presumed innocent until you're found guilty. And yet, we choose to usurp that. And I think that's a disservice to the basic principles of our nation.
Well, I guess I'd agree. And the other thing I'm curious about, since you kind of look at it on a nationwide level now, do places that have the death penalty and use it, I'm assuming Texas is probably way up there, do they have, I don't know, fewer violent crimes, you know, per capita? Is there any...
You know, that actually came up in this hearing I was at, and nobody knew the answer. So nobody knows that.
Really?
And if it is, you know, a deterrent, that's always something that's been said. But like I said, my position, and it would be an interesting fact to find out, but I think my position is more of the basis of justice for the victim. Like
sure.
I said, for these victims, it is the ultimate justice, and it's what a jury decided they deserve. And so that's where I'm just, that's where I come from on it. But like I said, nobody's really ever done the stats on it.
Wow, because you would think that if there's a, you know, huge deterrent that that would be, I don't know, but they're criminals and they're not usually all that smart, so I don't know, maybe they don't calculate those things.
And maybe they don't, I'm not sure. I mean, I would have to think when the three strikes law was in, it served as a deterrent. I mean, obviously, our crime went down during those years. So if you could base it off something like that, I suppose. But again, I think it's just the whole system of justice, and I think it does a disservice. And it's been 9 times, which I find it interesting that it's being litigated again, that it's come to the people of the state of California, and the people of the state of California have said, we want the death penalty reserved for the worst of the worst.
Speaking of the three strikes law, how do you think that's working?
Did we get rid of it?
No.
They modified it. I was against it. And my reason being is it now takes another victim to have your third strike implemented. When the law was originated, it was if you had 2 prior strikes, your third felony could be anything. And as far as I know, there is only one person that ever went to prison for a check writing as a third strike, but he had 2 prior murders.
They always throw up the case of some guy that stole some pizza or something, got his third strike, and that's why it's not fair. But
and that case is interesting because if you look at the facts, and I was privy to some of it, again, we're testing my memory, it wasn't that he just simply stole a pizza. These were kids. He was intimidating. There was a whole host of factors involved, mm-hmm. which is why the prosecution charged it. And I worked in the 3 strikes unit when it came in Sacramento County, and there was a lot of discretion used. It was not charged automatically on every case. There was a lot of scrutiny in people's backgrounds. Were they repeat murderers? Were they repeat rapists? Do we need them off the streets so the people are safe? You know, it was not a willy-nilly charging. And I put a lot of faith in our system. I put a lot of faith in our district attorneys. They're elected officials by their constituents. Obviously, if the constituents don't agree with them, they can unelect them. And there's a lot of discretion applied.
Do you think it helped criminals, so to speak, with prosecutors that didn't really want to give them their third strike?
Yes. And even if they did charge them with the third strike, a jury had to convict them. A jury had to find the prior strikes true. And a judge actually has the ultimate discretion to strike them. Mm-hmm. So there was protections in place. I did not personally see the abuse of it. A lot of the cases that have been brought up, I don't see them as abusive because people are forgetting the background of the person.
Right.
And that's just 2 convictions. The other thing that has to be looked at is sometimes people are convicted of a charge that's not reflective of what they actually did because it was a plea negotiation. So, for an example, somebody could be charged with rape, yet plead to a lesser offense of rape. They oftentimes were pled to false imprisonment because that was a way of negotiating the case, getting a good sentence, but yet sparing the victim from testifying. Well, false imprisonment doesn't show the same as a prior rape. So you also have to look at the circumstances behind the pleas and the charges.
Right. And we often don't hear those details. We only hear the outcome.
Correct. Yeah. And that's, you know, useful for people that want to have lesser sentences, is that right. Those details don't come forward.
And why you would want to do that, I don't know, because, I mean, I guess they don't think that any of these things could happen to their family.
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think a lot of people don't understand or haven't taken time to understand the net effect of crime, and not just on the families, but on, I mean, you think about it, on society in general. I know people always say, well, stealing from Walmart and things like that is a victimless crime. True, a person was not harmed, but yet the net effect is it's always passed on to the consumer. If it goes high enough, they have to cover their costs, you know, their insurance costs for liability and theft and things like that. That's why one of the biggest arguments was that first-degree burglary should not be a prior or serious, should not count as a serious or violent felony. Well, what people didn't realize is usually somebody going in a house to burglarize is going in with not just an intent to take property, but usually harm an individual. That's how a lot of rapes happen, things like that. So there was a reason why that stayed as a serious crime in our system.
And is that changed now?
No, it is still actually a serious crime. Carjacking, I believe, was removed from the list, which I thought was interesting, too, because a lot of people die as a result of carjacking.
Carjacking is not a serious crime?
No, it's not a serious crime anymore.
All righty, then. That's, I mean, who's making these? Who comes up with that?
Again, it's like I said, it was like this big waft that came through, and I don't just think there was a lot of vetting to it, unfortunately. And so now it's taking its toll on society, I think. But I think hopefully we can get it turned around.
My gosh, yes, that's just totally stupid.
You know, my goal would be to work even with the people that supported these initiatives, to meet with them, to talk to them and say, where can we agree to maybe look at some statistics, see what we can change before we have another poly class? You know, I'm very close to Mark, and I've seen his heart break, just like I watch my own parents' heart break, and I would love to prevent that from ever happening to a family.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Well, all those kinds of things, how can any of that be considered? Yeah, because what is it, non-serious, non-violent, non-something, and they had the, what is it, the three nons?
Right, it's non-serious, non-violent, and I forget what the third one is.
I do too. I always miss the third one. But some of the things that fall under that category are, I mean, you'd have a hard time convincing a normal person that actually applied. All right, we need to take one more quick break here, and we will be right back with Nina Salerno. We want to find out what's going on with Crime Victims United and how people can help you when we come back.
Okay, great. Hey, come on.
Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Rough, rough.
Nina's got a dog.
Yes, she does.
To talk to. If a man ever needed dying, he did. No one had the right to say what he said about you. And it's so cold and lonely here without you. Out there the laws are coming. I'm scared, so tired of running. Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't go back there. Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't go back there. I wish I had you to talk to.
Yeah.
definitely needs to be an application of the stalker law there. Where do you find this stuff?
That was some classic Los Angeles garage rock from the 60s.
You even have garage rock in there, huh? Wow.
If you were in Southern California in the 60s, you know it.
I did not know there was such a thing. Oh, that's funny.
Southern California in the 60s?
Well, I knew there was such that thing, but okay. I didn't. Okay, you didn't know about garage rock either, don't.
Garage rock, get out of here.
Did you know?
Oh, sure.
I need to get out more.
Yeah.
I was living in Connecticut. What the hell do I
know?
Have
you ever heard of the Archies?
Apparently not. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so
went over your head.
Yeah, get it. So we're here.
No, that was The Leaves, by the way, later redone by Jimi Hendrix.
So they had a garage band called The Leaves?
The Leaves.
Yeah. Huh. That was the first thing they had to do before they played every
day. Blow out the leaves.
Blow the leaves out of the garage.
Mom's like, those leaves are making too much noise in the garage, honey. That's funny. So Nina, with Crime Victims United, as you guys are kind of spreading this across the country and all that, how can people actually help you?
You know, people can help us by, obviously, you have our website. They're free to contact us. We do a couple annual fundraisers if they want to be supportive. If they can't, just being active and supporting legislation and going to their elected leaders saying, we want this, writing letters. We try to put out an update every week of what's going on across the state. Hopefully we'll be doing that across the nation soon. And just really being involved. And like I said, we do two annual events. One of the branches of Crime Victims United is a charitable branch, and it was generated from my passion because I was young when my sister was murdered. I don't think we do a real good service to young victims of crime of helping them. We provide therapy in our state, but we don't, you know, it's always, which is good that when somebody's in prison or juvenile hall, they're given education, they're given all these things to help make them better people, but we don't provide that for victims. So one of the things we try to do at the charity is we try to find young victims who have survived some pretty hard things and are going on to higher education to make a difference in the world, and we try to help fund their college years. So we always do something to support that, and then we always have an annual dinner. Like I said, David Clark Jr. spoke at it, where we raise funds to keep the political branch going. But a lot of that, outside of that, is people just being informed. You know, and we try to help educate the voters and being out there to help us educate them to be supportive of victims. And it's not just victims of crime, but it's public safety and law enforcement as well. Law enforcement is taking a very hard toll right now. I find it really almost, you know, I just find it sad that the people that put their lives on the line are actually being so disrespected publicly. I mean, I've been around law enforcement all my life. You know, as a prosecutor, I worked hand in hand with officers. And they go above and beyond, and yet they're being so disrespected. And that's not to say that in any profession there are some bad apples.
Sure.
But, you know, to disrespect their position of trying to keep us safe. And I was just talking with my fiancé the other night that these people that are disrespecting them have the right to disrespect them because of what we do, because we protect their rights. And I just think that's just kind of just an oxymoron, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, that's been really popular lately. I mean, along with all this whole, you know, kind of Occupy thing and all that, it is almost back to the 60s. Maybe the thing with the leaves, maybe I'll get current with all that on the second round. It seems like we're back there again.
It does. I mean, and it's, again, you know, people have rights in this country that, which are so, people have died for. I mean, here we're talking about it on Memorial Day weekend. My brother-in-law spent 27 years in the military and tours through Iraq just to preserve our rights. And some people take it such for granted. And it's okay to speak out. It's just the disrespect issue, I think, that's really kind of sad.
Sure. And without those folks, it's funny. It's almost like the whole atheism thing. You know, they're all big, solid atheists until something bad happens, and it's like, oh, God, you know.
Exactly. You know, and it's, you know, law enforcement, military, they don't discriminate who they help. They're still going to help you, but it just gets so forgotten. it's just sad. Like I said, and like today's fitting, being that it's Memorial Day weekend. You know, I always make our teenagers go and pay service and go to, you know, one of the events to realize that it's not just about barbecues and getting your family together and things like that,
yeah.
Which is all great. But we're able to do that because of the people that die for us.
Exactly. Well, you know, and the other group of people that are much maligned, and sometimes for good reason, are elected officials. But I know that you had the congressional office, you had Congressman LaMalfa's office write a letter to the parole board about your sister's case. Do you do that every single time he comes up?
I know your congressman very well. He's a personal friend. I admire him very much. I know it's a tough race up there. He's just, to me, what I know and worked with, he's always been there for his constituents to make sure public safety is in place. So he has always voluntarily written one, whatever office he served in. And we do that. We encourage victims to reach out when they are facing their own parole hearings, to not only have family and friends, but to have local leaders help support them in their quest to keep somebody that's not rehabilitated or remorseful in prison.
Does that help?
It does.
Well,
it does
figure
help
it can't
because
hurt,
the,
you know.
Right. The parole board does have to listen to public outcry. And, you know, because that person is going back to their county, to their,
yeah,
you know.
They're going back
and
to their community.
Right. And again, like I said, I can't stress enough that we believe in rehabilitation, and I've seen it work. And there are times when Crime Victims United have also assisted in those that have truly shown remorse and rehabilitation and worked with them in things to help reestablish. We had one of our scholarship programs is we always try to find a young kid that may have been going down a different path and rehabilitated and now is going out to do something good for the community, and we do give money towards that. So, you know, I don't want it to sound like we try to fight everything, but the cases I have worked on, the cases that I've come across with people, truly the person is still a danger to public safety.
Sure. And how, just out of curiosity, as a prosecutor, how often, I guess, did you see that, you know, someone come up for parole who completely faked their way out of the system or through the system to get out?
Oh, I think that's probably more often than not.
But does it work?
There's a term in the system called maligners.
Oh.
Yes, it does work. There's a term in the system called maligners, and they're very good. The other thing with the parole process that I think is very detrimental to society, to public safety, is they are given a psychological evaluation. And generally, everyone I've seen always says this person is a low risk coming back. But the problem with that, and I'm not jamming on the evaluators, for lack of a better word, I can think of a word, they are only given a limited time, and they're not given the case file. So they take the version of the facts from the inmate. And that's the person that has the most bias, obviously. The victims are not interviewed in it. They basically take the inmate's version, they look at the rehabilitation, and they write a report.
Hmm.
They spend maybe 2 to 3 hours with the person at the most. So it's a very skewed report in my, and it's unfortunate because they are relied on heavily in our system as the psychological evaluations. And I've always said, well, at least they should at least reach out to the victim, because there may be a whole version. And the one I can give you is that in my own case, I believe it's 13 or 14 different versions to how my sister was murdered that have been given. And each and every time he's been considered, except for one psychological evaluation where he was ruled moderate, he was always ruled low risk to reoffend. And I'm like, hey, wait, he can't even tell you the truth. You know, how do you say if somebody's rehabilitated if they can't even begin to say the truth?
And so if someone, I mean, violently kills someone, how do they, I mean, what kind of a story do they tell that makes them sound like they're low risk?
Well, the first 2 or 3 times, I believe he said that my sister had the gun, there was a struggle and it accidentally went off. Only the problem was that she was executed. So it's kind of hard to do that.
Yeah, kind
of then
hard.
The version was that he was in a fit of rage and because she was breaking up with him. Well, again, my point to the parole board is that's fine, but he stole the gun prior. He threatened her prior. He followed her to her college campus. He had the presence of mind after he shot her and left her to die in the streets. She died slowly and bled to death. He went up to his dorm room and watched Monday Night Football like nothing was wrong. That's not somebody that was in a fit of rage.
No. And does it hold any weight that he basically lied the first couple of times through the process? I mean, do they look at that?
They have brought that up in the last decision. They brought up some of the facts that I are. And again, I have a distinct advantage. I was a prosecutor, so, you know, and I can argue some things that maybe other people wouldn't pick up on. That's why I always encourage victims, this is just a side note, to reach out and at least talk to an attorney before they go to a parole hearing. They have a right to have one with them. And if they can do it and can afford it, you know, and I do it just on a pretty very minimal level to as far as cost-wise so that I can help as many as I can, because there are things that they as a victim may not think that are important, like, you know, the fact that he goes and watches, in my case, watch Monday Night Football right afterwards shows that he had presence of mind. And the case that I just argued where the husband killed the wife, well, he spent hours cleaning up the crime scene. That's not indicative of somebody, as he says, who just murdered his best friend and was lost.
Yeah, right. He was lost with a lot of Clorox and some sponges.
Somebody who wants to get away with it and has no remorse.
He suddenly, in a fit of cleaning, was very sad. Yeah. Wow, that's
so I do
bizarre.
Encourage victims heavily, and the district attorneys do a great job, but they're overwhelmed, to at least consult with a private attorney, to talk to them, you know, and to be versed in their rights as well, because lots of times, and again, it's just the way our system works. You'll have people say, oh, you can't speak. Well, no, they have an absolute right to speak, and they have to be heard. And so sometimes victims are very intimidated by that. So by reaching out and talking at least to some people that know their rights very well, can verse them on it, it empowers them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Besides that, I'm sure it's insanely emotional, and you get in there, and if you're not... You know, if you're not actually being helped by a professional, you could very easily leave and go, oh, all the things you didn't say. I think we've all done the steering wheel speech, you know, on our way home for one thing or another, job interviews and, you know, things as basic as that. You just lock up. You forget. We need to take one more quick break. We'll come back and finish out the top of the hour here with Nina. So, okay, Nina, you've got like 2 minutes to think of anything that we need to know that we don't know yet.
Okay, great.
Since we've obviously exhausted our information a long time ago reading your bio. We're talking about Crime Victims United today on the day before Memorial Day. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Rejoining We the People Radio here in our last 5 or 8 minutes or whatever it is. So, Nina, what's something else that you've seen from your vantage point that really people don't consider when they think about victims of violent crime? Uh-oh. She's coming.
Hello?
On. There you are.
Sorry.
No problem. So what are some things that people really don't consider, you know, as these, because let's face it, the things like Prop 47 are being passed because.
I mean, sorry, my dog.
All hell's breaking loose at Nina's house.
We're actually having a party for 100 people tonight, so there's people in and out of my house.
Release the hounds.
I apologize.
Classic.
Yeah.
It's a Pomeranian.
When we were just chatting, I think the, if I can encourage victims, public safety, I think knowledge is power. They're certainly welcome to call. I am always available to answer questions at the office. But I also think if people just want to be informed, we, you know, we do these updates. I try to do them weekly, once a month, and we try to put out something more comprehensive. And I just, my biggest thing as a prosecutor, as a victim advocate, is encouraging those that have been harmed to at least get know their rights. And if they choose to enact them, I think it's an empowering thing. I mean, I worked with a lot of the rape victims that they were initially scared to testify, but once they did, it was very empowering. You know, one of the things with rape is a crime of power. And when you can take that power back, I think it's the greatest service you can give a victim.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And for those people who think that, you know, with all this victim, you know, what is it, nonviolent and victimless crime and all that, before they pass some other dopey measure like Prop 47 or something like that, what would you, if you had a chance to, you know, sit all the voters down and give them a talking to, what would you tell them?
I just think, don't be fooled by ballot titles.
That's true.
We're very creative in the way we write ballot titles. When I say we, people that work in the political system can be extremely creative. Don't be fooled by ballot titles. Read between the lines. Ask questions. You know, a lot of them get promoted as Justice and Safety Act or the Public Safety Act of such and such a year. The net effect is they may be more harmful. It's kind of like when you're a young voter and you don't understand that a bond is a tax or things like that. I think being educated is important. I think when you're looking at who you want to elect, I mean, regardless of what party you are, I think you should elect what's best for your community. Whether you like Donald Trump or not, that's people's individual choices. I like the fact that our system is being shaken up by somebody who's not a career politician. I just think it's an interesting trend for once, and I think those kind of things are becoming important. I think people are getting a little bit tired of the norm, and hopefully that leads to more education of the general public.
Yeah, because some of this, when you realize what it's going to do, but I think what does happen is people go into the voting booth or they get their mail-in ballot and they do look at the title. And a lot of times
Correct.
It's the reform of blah, 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 blah. But really what it means is you're going to have more criminals in your neighborhood now.
Correct. I just think education is, you know, is powerful. And you may decide differently than I may decide, and that's our absolute right. But at least make your decision informed. You know, one of my closest friends is actually a defense attorney, and philosophically, we differ on mostly everything, but we can at least have an intelligent conversation and agree to disagree. And I think that is important when it comes to any of these kind of things.
Sure. Now, when it comes to ballot measures and things like that, I'm assuming that if there's something that involves victims' rights and that sort of thing, you guys probably have that on crimevictimsunited.com.
We do. We have both ways. If something is, you know, not, we think anti-public safety, yes, we do. And actually, my mom, and again, great credit to her. She's the strongest woman I've ever come across. Lots of times she's asked to sign on a lot of public safety measures on the ballot. So I also tell people to look at who are the supporters.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
Who's signing it or who's signing against it, because that can tell you a lot.
Yeah, because hopefully they've done their homework and they know what it's really about.
Correct. And, you know, that can tell you a lot about the measure. I mean, it was actually very interesting in 2008 when we did Marcy's Law, which amended the Constitution, because we were outfunded by like 7-1, I believe, trying to defeat this constitutional amendment. And I give great credit to the people of the state of California, because I think people really read about it and saw who was supporting it, and it passed overwhelmingly. You know, it takes 2/3 to amend the Constitution, and we were over the top, and we were completely outspent. And unfortunately, in our system, money can make a difference in the political system, obviously, in advertising and things like that. But for whatever reason, in that case, it became landmark that we won with so little funding and just a huge grassroots effort.
Gosh, that's awesome. And I'm assuming you work a lot with the sheriff's organizations and all the different
yes.
law enforcement agencies around the state.
Yes, and most people are connected with our website, and we all try to communicate. Again, it's trying to do the best we can, realizing it's never going to be perfect and there's a balance. I just think it's trying to do the best we can.
Yeah, and getting the information out there. It's real easy to sign up for the updates on your site. Just go to the bottom of crimevictimsunited.com, look at the bottom of the page, it says sign up for email updates. Bill signed up
correct.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Well,
yeah.
I hope I get to talk with you guys again. This has been great.
Well, thanks a million.
We appreciate you coming on.
Lisa,
it's very informative. We got some great responses out of our chat room. You really got folks fired up.
Oh, great. Well, again, and anybody's welcome to call if I can answer questions, and I hope to talk with you guys again. And have a great Memorial Day weekend.
You too. Thanks a lot, Nina. And
okay.
Lisa and Doug both said hi.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.